Welcome to the Spoolcast. Sid Harrell joins Jared Spool in a discussion about usability testing for mobile apps. Sid will be presenting one of the day-long workshops at the UX Immersion Mobile Conference April 7th through 9th in Denver. For more information, visit uxim.co. That's uxim.co. And now, here's Jared.
Hello, everyone, and here we are again at another episode of the Spoolcast. I'm so glad you were able to join us today. And I have with me someone else who I'm exceptionally glad was able to join us, the wonderful Sid Harrell, who is UX evangelist for Code for America, and she's one of the smartest people I know, particularly on the topic of conducting usability research for mobile apps, which is coincidentally the name of her workshop for the UX Immersion Conference that's going to happen April 7th till 9th in Denver. Sid, it is awesome to talk to you again.
It's fantastic to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, thanks for giving us the time. So last year you did this workshop, and I got to tell you, it rocked the house. People just love this. And I remember talking to folks afterwards, and one of the things that they loved so much about it was how much they were learning from other folks. And then I talked to you about it, and you talked about how much you learned from other folks in the workshop. What actually happened? I thought you were supposed to go and teach people stuff.
Well, I hope I did that. But at the same time, the field is evolving so quickly, and there are so many tools that people are out trying things in some cases that I haven't had a chance to try yet. And I wanted to respect that in my workshop. And so I said, number one, and I'll do this again this year, I think, this is going to be an open questions workshop. So people can ask questions at any time during the day. And in fact, also, I'd love to hear your stories of mobile research that you've tried for those of you who have already done this. And we had some really interesting ones. I had seen an article the week before the workshop by a woman named Tanya Lang in Australia, who'd figured out a way to do a scrolling paper prototype of a mobile application. And as it turned out, Tanya Lang was at the workshop and happened to have one of the paper frames that she constructed to make these with her. And so I asked her to stand up for a moment and, you know, show the audience from the source what this cool little paper prototyping technique was. And during the break, several people came up to me and talked about studies that they had successfully done where they had looked at people walking around stores or other things or variations on things that I had done. And I said, I would hate to have this kept to just the break time. So at the beginning of each section, I asked a couple of people to share those stories. And I think we all really appreciated that. I certainly did, because we're learning this together. And while you very kindly said that, you know, I'm known for this particular area, I think that there are many people out there experimenting, and the more of us can share with each other, the more quickly we'll understand what the best practices are, especially as they evolve so fast as the technology changes.
So, yeah, I mean, I think we're in this stage where everyone is just sort of getting used to the tools and figuring out what they can do and just sort of playing around. And it's a beautiful stage. I remember when we were just starting to do usability testing for what was then desktop computers, and in some cases for mainframes and mini computers back in the late 70s, early 80s. And we started to realize that, you know, we didn't have to do this like we were testing rats in a maze with a very strict protocol. We could start to play around in the sessions, and we started to experiment with different types of mechanisms for conducting user research, some of which were wildly successful and some of which were just dreadfully awful. But at the time, we got a chance to really sort of play with the idea of what is user research and how does it work. And I feel like we're sort of back in that mode again.
I think we are too. And, you know, it's interesting to see that there are developing some solutions to some of the problems that we talked about last year. At the time that we were talking last year, people were really figuring out, well, how do I allow any kind of observation when we're talking about a mobile screen. You know, do I need to restrict my participants to keeping their device on a square paper on the desk, which of course completely impedes their natural holding pattern in the sense of how their hand would normally hold a mobile device, in order to make the video look good to the people in the observation room? What are the trade-offs there? There are a lot better tools and positions and so forth that have evolved to do that this year, but people are still really playing with how do I research mobile device use in context. So I might be able to do something, and I know I have personally participated in moving car device research, in store walk-around device research with good Wi-Fi, in diary and experience sampling research where I send somebody a ping and they send me back, this is what I'm doing, or this is a picture of where I am. We still haven't figured out, but I bet that somebody is doing something cool that hasn't bubbled up to the front of my stream yet. How do I research some of these intermittent apps that we use throughout the day? Things like my transit app. Well, you'd have to happen to catch me at, you know, exactly 8:35 every morning when I pull out that app and furiously use it for the next 10 minutes. So I think there are some really important things that are coming out, partly tool-based and partly practice-based, to allow us to research the actual way that people use these in the context of mobile device use in their lives.
Yeah, I think that it's really sort of an interesting, fun time. I mean, some of this stuff gets really lo-fi and, you know.
You mean like scrolling paper prototypes on adding machine tape?
Yeah. Or just rubber banding screenshots to an actual phone, or
drawing screens on post-it notes. They're a great form factor for mobile phones.
Yep. I've seen people sketch something and then take a picture of it and then just use the photo app to simulate actual use patterns.
Well, you can do that, and then you got Pop App, which actually lets you put interactions into sketched prototypes.
Well, I haven't heard about this. What is Pop App?
This is cool, actually. I used it in the workshop, and it is exactly for taking a photograph of your sketches, and then you can put hotspots in it. So you can basically create a clickable prototype for a mobile app in, you know, 5 or 10 minutes.
That's very cool.
There's a ton of capability and a ton of tools and options, and it's funny. I went to review the tools that I had talked about last year, and just about everyone has at least significantly more competition than it had last year. So there are a bunch of options now if you would like to embed code in a native app and record the actual use patterns of people with their clicks and their faces. There are several options for screen sharing with a mobile device that didn't exist this past spring. And we're still talking in December, and you know, we'll be talking to your audience in April, and I'm sure we'll see a few more things develop even before then.
Yeah, it's just so crazy.
It's the Wild West.
It really is.
That's what I think is fun, honestly.
I think it is. I think to do user research with mobile, it has to be in your nature to be flexible and a quick learner.
I think so. But I think even if you don't think that's your nature, it's probably in you. You know, I have certainly continued to need to do that in my practice here at Code for America as we send these tiny little teams into cities to solve really big problems and build an app on a really short timeline. And I continue to evolve. Oh, okay, you have 2 days to do UX research on a kind of app I haven't heard of before. Let's figure it out. And I think that those are often what people need to do when they are faced with the need to do mobile UX research. They don't get months to plan it. It's sometimes an afterthought, or it's hard to shoehorn in there. And the reality is that the technical aspects of it can seem intimidating, but if you come at it with the right attitude and your trusty roll of duct tape, as I like to say, you can just about always put together a method to solve the research question. And putting together your own methods is actually one of the most fun parts of doing any kind of design research, I think.
Well, so I'm intrigued by this. Tell folks what you're doing at Code for America. I think a lot of folks probably haven't heard too much about it. And you've been doing some really particularly interesting stuff with mobile there.
That's right. I'm really proud of several of the things that came out of the projects this year. So Code for America is a nonprofit And one of the major things we do is run a fellowship program. We bring in techies and designers, and we put them in small teams of three or four together with an American City Hall. And the idea is for them to solve a significant problem that City Hall has identified through building some technical solution and also teaching and embodying the practices that go along with that. So a couple of the interesting ones this year, in San Francisco, the problem that our fellows were tasked with was helping keep people's food stamp benefits current. And the practice, it doesn't sound all that technical, right? The practice that existed in the city was that they would send people letters and people had to reconfirm, yes, I still have income below a certain level. Yes, these family members are still living with me. They had to fill out a complicated form that would be delivered to them by snail mail with not a lot of time to spare. And so something like 2 or 3% of San Francisco's beneficiaries were falling off the rolls every month, and they wouldn't find out about it until they went to purchase groceries at a store.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's a nasty moment, right? You're there with your kids in a grocery line with that nice debit card that looks like everybody else's debit card. And suddenly you get this, I'm sorry, ma'am, your benefits are no longer active. You'll have to put all that food back.
Wow.
Yeah. And so what our fellows realized after observing at the sign-up center for Human Services Agency in San Francisco is that most of these adults who are in this program actually had text-capable smartphones, smartphones or feature phones, I should say. And they were able to persuade the city of San Francisco to implement a policy change to collect cell phone numbers from beneficiaries and set up an application by which, instead of sending a snail mail letter, which of course is problematic because often people who are on public benefits have less stable addresses than people who are a little higher up the socioeconomic spectrum, but their cell phones often stay constant. And so the HSA now is able to batch send a text message to people saying, we need to reconfirm these facts about you and you can call this number and speak with one of our representatives. And they had close to 1,000 people sign up in the pilot and have presented a whole bunch of people from losing their benefits through the use of mobile phones with a clever service design.
That's really cool. And so to build this out, your guys did a lot of different types of research, yes?
Yes, they did what you would think of as fairly traditional ethnographic research in observing in a physical space. They met with clients and understood what types of phones they had and what their capabilities were. They did some research around language and accessibility. So there's a double language issue there, right? You have a set of languages, some of which are English and some of which are not, that people are most comfortable with. And then you also have language limitations in terms of the space of an SMS message and language limitations in terms of what reading level you want to pitch those to. So they did a tremendous amount of refining the language and the way that this would appear on some of the crummiest feature phones out there to make sure that people would understand what was happening, but not be scared and not overinterpret the message to think that it said you are losing your benefits right now, but that it just said, well, there's something you need to take care of here to make sure that everything keeps going. They didn't do anything that I would call traditional lab research. It was just about all in the field. They did a little bit of piloting each research project with some of their colleagues who were on other teams here that were associated with other cities. But by and large, they used techniques that we would recognize from most stages of user research and just kind of rejiggered to work with people who have feature phones, who have a harder time responding to a fancy survey like might come from Typeform or SurveyMonkey Mobile or one of those things that are actually great. They paired it back to the basics.
And when you say paired it back to the basics, you mean?
I mean, talking with individuals, tracking them down. If they didn't respond to an initial request for feedback, and watching them use the actual prototype on their own personal actual phones rather than on test models.
And some of the surprises that they ran into, what were those?
Well, I think these guys were surprised by exactly how spare and clear and essential they had to make the copy. Almost all of it could be considered microcopy. So how do you convey a complex idea like you need to complete a required form within the next X days in order to continue in effect these benefits, which have a really bureaucratic name, but which you know as your food card, while still satisfying the legal requirements related to the language. So there was a ton of iteration, and they were very surprised by how much of it was copywriting. And then, of course, and this is kind of interesting because I think this happens a lot, there's a maintenance aspect on the back end that isn't on a mobile device. So working out the back end system for this, which is called Promptly, by the way, so that it made it hard for government officials who were sending messages to make mistakes and send the wrong message or an inappropriate message to any of the actual end users of the app who were experiencing it on their mobile phone. That took a lot more effort than expected.
Yeah, I mean, I was just talking to Karen McGrain, and we were talking about how the back ends get neglected way too often.
I think it's really true. And I think a big component of a mobile experience is, you know, where is it coming from?
Right.
And often it is coming from an experience in a different realm. So in order to deliver an excellent mobile experience, they had to look at also a desktop web-based experience that was part of how the government officials would create this experience over time for the actual beneficiaries.
Was that something that came to them from the very beginning of the project, or was that something they sort of discovered along the way as, oh my gosh, we have to think about that?
They discovered it along the way. To their credit, they set it up and they thought about the end user experience first, which I think is the lens that we always want to think from. And then as they started to train the people who would be working with this system after they left town, they realized that how incredibly important it was to have a great experience for them as well.
Yep. That makes perfect sense. All of that seems, again, this idea of just having this full toolbox at your beck and call and looking at the research you need to do at the moment and saying, okay, what tool is best? And reaching into that toolbox and grabbing something that could do the job pretty well and just going ahead with it.
Yes. Like I say, my favorite thing in the toolbox is always duct tape, because sometimes a hammer is what you got, and it seems like a screwdriver would be better, but maybe you can make it work with a nail.
That's very funny. Years ago, we did this project. I'm talking 1980s. We did this project for a large construction tool manufacturer, a large manufacturer of construction tools. The tools were actually not very large. Home construction, carpentry, that sort of thing. And so we would go out on these sites where there were all these master carpenters, and we would spend a lot of time watching them use it. And one of the things we were focusing on were how they use drills. And
this sounds so fun, by the way.
Yes, yes, it was a blast. It was absolutely a blast. And these were really talented, smart people we were working with, and they were really dedicated to what they were doing, and they loved their job, and they loved their tools, and their tools were part of them. But we were paying attention to the electric drills, and the electric drills, we actually spent time measuring what they were used for in the course of a project. And they're used for drilling holes very infrequently, it turns out. They do get used as hammers, and they have to be made rugged because sometimes the drill is easier to grab than the hammer. But the number one thing that they are used for on a construction site, particularly an outdoor construction site, is to hold the blueprints down. And in fact, the manufacturer we were working with eventually put a paper clip. They built into the plastic shell a clip that you could use to clip papers to the drill, because so many people used it to hold essential papers down while it was on site. And then inevitably they'd grab it real quick, and whatever papers it was holding down would go flying. And they're like, okay, we can clip the papers to it, so at least that doesn't happen.
That's amazing. What a great story. I do think we are in a space like that with the tools for mobile research, right? There are getting to be some great mobile survey tools, for example, and I think the people who make them are focusing on that as their use case. But what someone like me is likely to do is say, okay, I want people to give me a screenshot of whatever's on their mobile phone around commute hours every day. So I'd like to use one of the text blasting systems to recruit a list of people and send them all an SMS at about 8:30 their time and ask them to take a screenshot, put it into one of these surveys, and maybe my survey will just be, I'd like a caption for the picture that you're taking. And I'd like you to answer two radio button questions and then send it off. So I don't use a lot of the features of the survey in terms of complex branching logic and so forth, but I make it. I give it a shortened URL from one of those services. I use one of the text blast services to send it out to people. I do some scheduling, probably with, you know, when is good or something like that, in order to figure out when to send things to people. And then I'm going to use something on the back end to collect all of the photos and responses that I get. Maybe that's just, you know, Google Docs and Dropbox, right?
Right.
But all of a sudden, I've taped together an experience sampling remote research tool for mobile users of commuting applications.
Yeah, see, that sort of thing is really cool. And of course, you know, hopefully the tool vendors are paying attention to all this and saying, okay, we can get rid of the duct tape parts of this and actually make this something useful. But it is neat that we have all these little components and we can start to plug them together and do something really cool with them.
I agree. I think we have the basics, really. If there is any kind of research question that people want to solve about mobile phones, I think we have absolutely the technology available to solve it. It's just perhaps going to require a little duct tape and a little ingenuity, and in some cases, a fair amount of time. Partly because there are some of the basic pieces that we don't have in the way that we have data from 25 or 30 years of usage of desktop computers. I saw a great study yesterday. It was actually from February, where someone stood on the streets of New York and observed in what position people were holding their mobile phones as they walked by.
Oh, Luke Rabushki was talking about something similar, where some dude went out and looked at which hand they were holding it in and whether they were using their thumb to operate it or their forefinger.
Yeah, I think it must be the same study. It was in UX Matters a while ago.
Yeah, and it was like 1,700 people they observed. Some incredibly large sample size. And they got some really interesting breakdowns on how people held it. It was purely sort of street observation stuff.
Yes, no consent, just public space.
Yep. And in New York, you can do that because no one in New York wants to look at other people. So they all walk down the street looking at their phones. In fact, there was a video that somebody put out about people bumping into people walking down the street with their phones. And then somebody else was doing something about standing in front of people as they walk down the street looking at their phones to see if they notice you before they collide with you.
Oh, that's too funny.
But yeah, no, it was all that same sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, the type of data we can collect and gather now is really fascinating.
Yeah, and then you've got, you know, really useful basic resources like the Pew Internet and American Life Project, which I hope everyone is tracking, because that's where I find out, you know, most recently in October, they said, well, we've crossed a line, right? A majority of American adults now have smartphones, and 90% of American adults now have cellular phones of one kind or another. So, you know, one of the things that that is a great piece of data to take back to your management and say, we need to be thinking about mobile. And of course, one of the things that we talk about in terms of access for everyone is that there are getting to be more and more mobile-only internet users in the United States, as well as in a lot of countries around the world.
Yeah, I keep hearing stories about people giving up their machines, or they're just not near a desktop machine most of the time, and therefore their mobile is the only way they're interacting with the majority of websites. And it's not unusual. I see this like on the train all the time. Someone has their laptop open, but they're interacting on their phone at the exact same moment.
Yes, those combinations, I think, are very interesting. It makes me feel good about the little hack that we've all been using for mobile remote research for a while, which is to turn a laptop around and hug it.
Right.
So that the phone can be seen. Well, that's not quite as unrealistic as maybe we thought at the time.
Yeah, explain that hack a little more, because I've seen it, but I bet a whole bunch of folks haven't seen this crazy thing that you guys do.
Well, I actually have to credit it to the wonderful Jen Downs from MailChimp and a couple of folks at Mozilla started around the same time, but she was the first one to present it that I saw. And the idea is you have a webcam on most laptops right at the top there. If you angle the screen down just a little bit and turn the laptop around so that the camera is then pointing away from you, and then you give the laptop a cuddly little hug, so that you hold your mobile phone kind of underneath the overhanging screen section of the laptop, the webcam will be pointing right at your hand using the phone. And so if you enter GoToMeeting or Skype or Google Hangout or any of those things that makes use of the webcam, you suddenly have a remote research setup where you can see everything the user is doing on the phone.
Yeah, that's just such a clever technique. You know, it's with equipment we already have.
Yes. Yes, and you know, GoToMeeting is now allowing you to broadcast your screen from a tablet, which is great. And they have a GoToAssist as well, which will let Android screens be shared from a phone. Don't ask me the phablet question because I don't know the specs on that. It hasn't come up in any of my projects. But there's, again, a thing where I will bet someone who will attend my workshop will know.
Right. When I came into your workshop last year, you had this comfortable chair in the front of the room, and you weren't using it to torture anybody, I don't think.
You have to ask the guy who was my guinea pig. I think his name was Greg, and he was very nice. So one of the things that I think is really important is to put the user, if you're doing a lab study, in a somewhat plausible context, and that can really be just a small thing. So what we did back when I was at Bolt Peters, and what I've continued to do, is if I want to have a mobile research session and show the participant's screen to observers in another room, instead of having the person put their phone on, say, a square of paper on a table and then poke at it with their finger in a very unnatural way, I give them a comfortable armchair so that they can hold the phone in either, you know, their right or their left hand, and then I stick a flip cam or a GoPro or an iPivo or really any little camera that has a broadcast capability on a microphone boom and adjust it so that the person can be using their phone one or two-handedly as they normally would, and the people in the observation room can get a feed from that little camera on a boom.
That's really cool.
And yet really simple.
Yeah. Yeah. That's got to really put people at ease being in that comfortable chair.
Yeah. It's a really big difference. And I think, you know, given what we know from that study where the guy observed the 1,300 people, and I think his name was Steve Huber, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds right.
Yeah. What we know from that and the way that people preferentially hold their phones, I think you're going to get much more reliable data, not just because the person is comfortable, but because the person is doing something in the way that they normally would.
Yeah, I think that there's nothing realistic about a usability test, and we always sort of delude ourselves when we're trying to make it realistic, but there isn't anything realistic about it. But if people are focusing on their posture, they're being distracted from everything else, and it does create this more issues with what you're trying to learn. And, you know, because participants tend to want to please you in a study, if you're making them do something that really requires thought and concentration in a way that they normally wouldn't do it, you're now taking away from their natural reactions and things like that. And I think that that's where the problem comes from. So making it feel natural lets you focus on the things that are really what you came to focus on, and not, you know, can someone keep their posture in an awkward position for 20 minutes?
Right. And I think even, you know, if you got out your phone right now and set it on your desk and try to open your email and read a couple using only your pointer finger, it wouldn't be an accurate representation of how quickly you're able to use it.
No, I'm at like half speed. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it makes perfect sense to me that we'd want to do it this way.
Yeah. We'll definitely demonstrate that. And there are a lot of variations of that that you could do, of course.
Well, I'm really excited to see the workshop this year and to see all the new stuff that you're going to be adding into it, and how people are going to come out with this sort of rich sense of all the different tools they can use to get there. And also, you know, the Code for America stuff is so cool. Every time I hear about a new project that you guys are doing, I'm just blown away. And so I'm anxious to hear more about how you guys are doing that, in particular, how you're using all this mobile stuff, because I bet you are not letting your fellows get away without doing research.
Yeah, with me on site, they don't have a lot of excuses. We had to actually do a voice UX project as well, which was another way to accommodate people using feature phones. So it's fascinating. I love my job, and I love the evolution that's happening in mobile. And I'm really excited, too, to find out what people have been up to as they're trying to tape together mobile research on their own.
Well, this is great. Thank you for spending this time explaining all this to us and helping me understand what is going on in this world of mobile research and how it's the Wild West and we can use it to our advantage right now.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's so much fun, and I'm always delighted to talk to you.
Fabulous, fabulous. I want to thank our audience for spending the time listening to us. And of course, thank you once again for encouraging our behavior. Hey, if you're listening to this on iTunes, it would be awesome if you went and gave us a rating. You know, whatever you think, just put it in there because it's how people discover this. And if you think it's worth other people discovering it, or if you think it's worth warning people away from it, that's what the ratings are for. So that would be awesome if you could take a moment and do that. Oh, and you can catch Sid at the UX Immersion Conference, April 7th through 9th, doing her full day workshop, conducting usability research for mobile apps. It's a fabulous workshop and you don't want to miss it. So just go to uximm.co and you will find all the workshops that are there, including Sid's, which will be on April 7th. Again, that's April 7th through 9th, Denver, Colorado. Hope to see you there. We'll talk to you again next time on the Spoolcast. Thank you so much. Take care.
More information about the UX Immersion Mobile Conference in Denver, Colorado, April 7th through 9th, visit uximm.co. That's uximm.co. As always, thank you for listening.